At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today, produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Forget Walmart and all those other big companies. You want to talk jobs in this economy, you got to talk small businesses. The president knows that, so he was talking the talk today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Elance, where businesses can connect with programmers, designers, marketers, and other independent professionals to get jobs done. You can build a team online at elance.com. And by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing, online surveys, and event marketing. ConstantContact.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Tuesday today, the 2nd of February, and it is great to have you here. President Obama did a factory tour and a town hall meeting in Nashua, New Hampshire today, and he rolled out yet another proposal to pump up small businesses. This one is aimed at community banks and getting them to lend more to small firms specifically so those firms can start hiring again. It's going to use $30 billion from the bank bailout, the TARP, to do it. From the Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting, Mitchell Hartman reports.
Lending to small business is down by a quarter since the recession began. Credit lines and home equity loans have been canceled. Bank loans have been harder to get. Bob Coleman, who publishes a newsletter on small business borrowing, says the president's plan will surely help.
$30 billion with a B is certainly a positive development for the entrepreneur on Main Street. That entrepreneur needs the local community bank to meet payroll, to fund their working capital, to pay their vendors.
But Coleman says even with $30 billion in new government capital and financial incentives for banks, it may still be hard for a cash-starved small business to land a loan. After a lousy year, many of them don't look creditworthy on paper.
That small business person walks into the bank and, first of all, revenues have decreased and most likely profitability, if there is any at all. Bankers are risk averse.
And some small business owners are now bank averse. Greg Carpenter owns a retail bakery in Michigan.
We were in a cycle where we would get some credit, do something new, get more credit to do something else new. The recession was the best thing to ever happen to our business.
Carpenter says when the recession hit, he scaled back the business, and he paid off a lot of credit card and bank debt he'd racked up trying to grow. Now he uses current cash flow to pay for supplies and make payroll. He says when he's ready to expand again, it'll be funded by sales revenue or private investors, not borrowing. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Small businesses, by the way, they account for 60%, more than 60%, of all the new jobs in this economy. If you think the United States has budget problems, I direct your attention now to Athens, Greece. Tomorrow, the European Union will give its official verdict on that country's public finances. The Greeks hope the EU might give them a helping hand with their debt load. The signs, though, are that it won't. The EU is more likely to prescribe some tough love, including deeper public spending cuts. Financial markets both here and abroad will be watching tomorrow's announcement because the Greek debt crisis has triggered the biggest test yet for the European currency, the euro. From London Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
The numbers are truly awful. A budget deficit headed for 13% of GDP, total national debt hurtling towards 140%. Hardly surprising, says Neil McKinnon of VTB Capital, that investors have been dumping Greek government bonds.
They're extremely worried that the Greek government is not capable of addressing the situation and that the ultimate end game in all of this could actually be a default itself.
Fear of default is contagious. It's hit the bonds of other heavily indebted Eurozone governments, those of Spain, Italy and Portugal. This has sent the euro reeling. The single currency has fallen sharply against the US dollar. Daniel Hannan is a member of the European Parliament.
What we're seeing in the low value of the euro is a question mark over whether the currency is going to survive at all.
If the euro fell apart, the European dream of having a currency to rival the greenback would disappear. But, says Graham Mather of the European Policy Forum, the US wouldn't be celebrating. It would create turmoil and protectionism in Europe, the biggest market for American exports.
People would be looking to their own economies first and trying to create barriers to world trade. So for US policy, a breakup of the eurozone would be very unwelcome indeed.
The collapse of the eurozone is still unlikely, but there is a more immediate worry for the US and other governments hoping to borrow large sums. Investors are growing very wary of government bonds. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
To lighter fare now, Oscar nominations were announced this morning, and if you believe the hype, the big contest is going to be between Avatar and an indie movie called The Hurt Locker. But even the long shots have probably already started drafting their acceptance speeches, not just the stars either. You know, the biggest moment on Oscar night is when the Best Picture winner is announced and all the producers file up onto the stage to pick up their little statuettes. But when the Best Picture nominees were unveiled this morning, there were some specifics kind of missing.
The Blind Side, nominees to be determined. The Hurt Locker, nominees to be determined.
All right, wait a minute. The movies have Oscar nominations and they still don't even know who the producers are? Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has more.
The job of movie producer sounds really important and really vague. Traditionally, the producer was like the CEO, hiring and managing staff, handling payroll, attracting investors. But since the big studios split up and everybody started getting into the movie business, things have gotten complicated. Mark Lachter follows the business of Hollywood for LA Observed.
Production companies, hedge funds that finance movies, we have all kinds of different entities, and more people mean more producers, and more producers mean more credit.
And less credibility, says Alex Ben Block, senior editor of The Hollywood Reporter.
Even worse than a catch-all, it had become a joke. So many times a personal manager or the uncle of the star or somebody was able to use their leverage to say, I'm the producer.
The result was that a movie would often have more than a dozen producers, which can really be a drag on an award ceremony. So about 5 years ago, the Academy ruled that only three producers could accept the Oscar for Best Picture. Getting Hollywood types to stand down wasn't easy, so the Producers Guild had to start holding hearings and snooping around.
They will actually reach out now to people who worked behind the scenes on the movie, maybe makeup people or cinematographers, and they say, what exactly did this person do?
Ben Block says the process can be such a catfight that sometimes producers aren't named until just days before an award ceremony. So if The Hurt Locker or The Blind Side gets the Oscar for Best Picture, it's not clear who will be thanking the Academy. In Los Angeles, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
There was some glitz and glamour on Wall Street. Today we'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's fresh evidence today that the recession is making it harder for Americans to put food on the table. A study released this morning shows 37 million people get emergency food assistance from soup kitchens and food banks every year in this country. That is one of every eight Americans. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler has the details.
Rising unemployment has pushed the number of households facing hunger up by more than 54% in the last 4 years. The study comes from Feeding America, a national network of food banks. Spokesman Ross Frazier says researchers interviewed 61,000 people seeking assistance.
Many of them said that they have to sit down and look at their expenses each month and say, am I going to pay my rent or am I going to feed my family? Am I going to keep the heat on or am I going to feed my family?
Lisa Hamler-Fugit directs the Ohio Association of Second Harvest Food Banks.
The demand for food assistance continues to grow day over day, week over week, and month after month.
Fugate says that, similar to other states, food banks in Ohio are cutting back for lack of funding.
Some are reducing the number of times that families and individuals can seek assistance from them. They're lightening the bag, where once they were giving a 5-day supply, they've had to reduce that to a 3-day supply.
That's especially hard on the 14 million children in this country without enough to eat. Again, Ross Frazier.
A child who's going without food today is at risk of physical and mental impairment. Their brains don't develop normally, so they become an adult who either can't work or can work only in a minimal capacity.
He says the consequences of child malnutrition will create a drag on the economy long after this recession has ended. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
At one time or another, a lot of us have probably had jobs that were a good deal more physical than what we're doing now, maybe even actually difficult or dangerous. A lot of those kinds of jobs are at the lower end of the economic ladder. They are often done by minorities or Latino migrant workers. Gabriel Thompson spent the better part of a year doing some of that kind of work in the lettuce fields of Yuma, Arizona, and in a chicken processing plant in Alabama. He wrote about his experiences in a book called Working in the Shadows. Gabriel, welcome to the program.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Tell me about the average day of a lettuce picker in the American economy.
One of the things that's just incredible is how much work farm workers do. So in Yuma, every day, about 12 million heads of lettuce are cut.
Say that again. 12 million every day.
12 million every day. So on a typical day, we'd start around 7:30 in the morning, maybe end around 6 p.m. And during the course of a day, I could be asked to cut about 3,000 heads. You're also trimming and you're bagging. So your typical day looks like a lot of time spent stooped over, usually squeezed between two other cutters in a very thin row, feet aching, hands aching, but also, you know, strangely, a lot of camaraderie among the other workers.
Yeah, which was interesting because you're not a guy who fits in with the standard migrant worker profile. I mean, you're a white guy, you're 30, 35 at this point that you're doing this job.
Yeah, no, I never saw another white person in the fields. And our crew kind of became known as the crew that had the white guy who, at one point, I think some people thought I was an undercover immigration agent.
Hmm.
Eventually, they just figured when I wasn't trying to deport anyone that I was, you know, a nice guy who maybe wasn't completely right in the head.
This book veers inevitably into immigration policy. And, you know, one of the big threads through that debate is that illegal immigrants in this country are taking jobs that Americans would ordinarily want to do. There aren't, though, very many Americans who are going to want to do these kinds of jobs.
One of the things I found was both in the lettuce fields and in the poultry plant, and especially I'd say in poultry because also in that situation working with whites and blacks, U.S. citizens, there wasn't that same amount of anger about the threat of immigrants taking jobs. The real challenge was surviving the jobs. So, you know, when I got a job at the poultry plant, I was hired within a week, went through an orientation. A week after that orientation, half the people in my orientation class had quit.
Hmm.
So if anyone wants to right now, it's listening, they can go to Yuma and steal back a job in the lettuce fields.
It struck me, actually, as I was reading this book, that the most substantive parts are about food, lettuce and chicken. And I was thinking how far removed we are from, you know, where our food comes from.
Yeah, there's a huge movement around food right now. And I think that movement, looking at, you know, where the food comes from, whether or not it's grown organically, hasn't quite yet looked enough at who are the workers within that food system and in what ways can we make their lives better?
For as tired and as physically beaten down as you were at the end of a day in the fields or at the chicken plant, you could basically go back to your rented room and collapse. But you were working with people who had kids in school, who had to take care of their parents. I mean, they had other obligations, and I'm wondering how they did it if you were so wiped out.
Yeah, I wonder that to this day. But it's true, the amount of sacrifice that people will do, and often it's not, they'll talk about improving their own lot, but really it was they didn't want their kids to be farm workers.
Gabriel Thompson's book is called Working in the Shadows. Gabriel, thanks a lot.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Former Fed Chairman Paul Volcker was on Capitol Hill today. He was talking bank regulation. Mr. Volcker seems to have the president's ear on that topic now. He favors making what is too big to fail smaller and limiting the kinds of risks that those banks can take. There is also some hope that Congress is going to create some kind of Consumer Financial Protection Agency, or CFPA. Commentator David Skeel says you can count on that.
If this sounds surprising, it is. The Federal Reserve doesn't like the CFPA, since the Fed would lose its authority over credit card and mortgage abuses. Neither do banks, which don't want a frisky new regulator looking over their shoulders. But even the Fed itself now admits that it did a lousy job protecting consumers before the crisis. The stability of the banking system is the Fed's primary concern, so it never made much sense for the Fed to be consumers' regulatory champion. The CFPA also is an antidote to the widespread anger at the billions of dollars that have been funneled to Wall Street throughout the crisis. It's a chance to finally do something for the little guys. Since the recent Massachusetts vote, there has been rampant speculation that the CFPA might be abandoned. But the Obama administration knows they can't afford to miss this opportunity, and lawmakers know it too. The real question isn't whether there will be a CFPA. There will be. It's whether the banking industry can pull out the new agency's teeth. They persuaded the House to carve out a huge exception from the agency's authority. Hundreds of community banks will be excluded from its coverage. The key issues in the Senate are whether the senators will agree to this loophole and what other exceptions will be built in. The other big question is personnel. The banking industry will fight hard for a regulator who will leave them alone, for anyone other than Harvard Law Professor Elizabeth Warren. Warren was the one who dreamed up the new consumer agency, and she's been a thorn in banks' side for years. So the real test will be who Warren is working for at the end of the year. If she's working for the CFPA, we'll know that Congress finally put the interests of consumers ahead of banks' profits. If she's still at Harvard, we'll know that the profits and the gravy train that runs between Washington and Wall Street still come first.
David Skeel is a professor of corporate law at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a comment you would care to share, you can do so at our website. It's marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Coming up, forget renting a car on vacation. Why not bounce around town on a bike?
With BikeShare, you swipe your card, you take any bike, you don't have to reserve ahead of time, and you can return it to any other station.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials moved up 111 points today, just over 1%, closed at 10,296. The NASDAQ relocated 18 points higher, not quite 1%, finished at 2190. The S&P 500 added 14 points. It's about 1.3%, wrapped up trading at 1103. Shares of the home builder Toll Brothers built up more than 5.5%. Today, Pulte Home nailed a 7.5% gain. Fort Worth's D.R. Horton got a double bump. It reported quarterly earnings today of nearly $200 million. Shares rose more than 10%. Lexmark was all about black ink today. The maker of computer printers reported quarterly profits of nearly $60 million. Shares cranked up nearly 12% today. Bond prices rose. When that happened, the yield goes the other way. The yield on the 10-year T-notes on this Tuesday fell to 3.63%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. Let us give you the business 24 hours a day. Just tap marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest financial news and reports from around the globe on how the economy is affecting our lives.
Mm-hmm. From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. A House Committee on Technology and Innovation holds a hearing on research and development of airline passenger screening. Over 500 people from more than 40 countries are expected to gather in Washington to focus on what we eat. The annual Global Food Safety Conference begins. And something outdoorsy. The United States National's snow sculpting competition gets underway in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
The news from the American housing market on this Tuesday was pretty much flat. A report on pending home sales, that is, the contracts have been signed but not yet sealed and delivered. They rose just a hair. It's better than falling, to be sure, but a story we did about an unexpected drop in actual sales a couple of weeks ago raised a listener hackle or two. We pointed out that housing experts were a bit confounded by the sales decline. Ron Greer from Tallahassee, Florida said, "Forget about analyst anxiety already, will you?
Where is the sympathy for those shut out of the home market because prices galloped far ahead of inflation and even ahead of incomes that continue to drop in real terms?"
So I have this theory about the numbers that we do on the show. I always figured that people just listen for the first couple of bars of the music, you know, whether it's We're in the Money or Stormy Weather, just to figure out if things were up or down for the day, and then they tune out. They don't pay any attention to what I actually say about the markets. Robert Jennings from Columbus, Ohio, has proved me wrong. The other day, I mentioned Eastman Kodak shares, and I called Kodak the company that had invented the digital camera. Mr. Jennings takes it from there.
I was prepared to send Marketplace my first comment ever, chastising you on your misinformation. Instead, I am happy to send you my first comment ever, saying thanks for helping me to learn something new.
Staying with electronics now, we ran a story not too long ago about printer cartridges and how the National Conference on Weights and Measures wants to regulate them so you know how many pages you can print with the ink that's left inside. Kim Alexander from Sacramento, California, wrote to say that that reminds her of something she has been meaning to bring up.
How automobiles also lack standardization in how much gasoline is actually left in the tank when the fuel gauge reads empty.
Finally, in letters this week, money in politics. A couple of weeks ago, the Supreme Court said companies do indeed have a First Amendment right to spend their own money for or against specific candidates and political campaigns. That prompted this thought from Robert Fisher of Patchogue, New York.
If corporate rights are equated with individual rights, as the Supreme Court determined, then corporations should have the right to bear arms. Imagine ExxonMobil with a private army.
That is actually the Second Amendment, Mr. Fisher, not the first, but I get what you're saying. If you don't get what we are saying, please let us know. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Depending on where you live, you may be familiar with some of those car share programs. You sign up for something like Zipcar, you pay a membership fee, and then you rent a car by the hour. You pick it up in a neighborhood nearby. It seems to work pretty well. This summer, though, look for bike share in a city close by. From WNYC in New York City, Andrea Bernstein explains.
If you have a car share near you, it probably works like this.
With Zipcar, you have to go online ahead of time. You have to reserve your car for a certain time. You have to write in when you're going to return the car, and you have to return it to the exact same spot.
That's Nicole Friedman, who runs the bike share program in Boston, set to be up and running with 1,000 bikes this summer.
With bike share, you swipe your card, you take any bike, you don't have to reserve ahead of time, and you can return it to any other station.
That's the way bike share works in Paris, one of dozens of European cities that have it. There have been problems with theft, but some 100,000 riders a day use bike share in the City of Light. You pay a yearly membership and a small fee per use. Tourists get special deals.
And people ask me all the time, is it like Zipcar on bikes? I always say, no, it's Zipcar on steroids.
Okay, but bike share is different from car share in one way. It's not as profitable and needs more infrastructure, kiosks, bike lanes, and specially designed bikes that are rugged and theft-resistant. It'll cost Boston more than $3 million a year to run its program. That has to come from government money, private sponsors, and bike rental fees. Bill Dossett runs the Minneapolis bike share.
Times have changed really quickly. When we started this process a year and a half ago, we didn't even know if there was a manufacturer out there that wanted to sell us this equipment.
Now companies are vying for the business and quickly developing anti-theft technology. Lee Jones is sales manager for the bike share company B-Cycle, which will be running Denver's system. They've installed electronic identification chips and GPS devices in the bikes.
And what this gives us the ability to do is not only know who has the bike, but more importantly, to know where the bike has been.
Jones acknowledges there's a risk. No one knows how a large-scale bike share will work in a major U.S. city.
But this year, 2010, is really kind of the first time that we will have actual installations open to the public.
So you want to check it out?
Yeah, I want to see how this
works. Do you want a helmet or are you good?
There have been some demonstrations. To find out how bike share might be received, I took a ride with musician David Byrne in New York City's Union Square.
I think it'll make it easier for a lot of my friends that we can just go out and get around together. And the people who don't have room in their apartment, people who come from out of town, stuff like that, we just say, okay, grab a bike and we'll go to a movie or we'll go get something to eat or whatever.
Meantime, some cities are already signing up corporate sponsors, like Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota. Patrick Garrity is the CEO. For $1 million, his company's name will be emblazoned on kiosks and bicycles moving all over Minneapolis.
We thought it was a great deal, and we think it reinforces our message about physical activities.
Bike czars like Boston's Friedman and Minneapolis's Dossett are working on developing incentives for cyclists. Minneapolis is selling memberships for $60 a year, but it's throwing in a $200 coupon book for restaurants and downtown businesses.
That's something really important for what we're trying to do. We are doing something totally new. People don't know about it. We need to create a market for it.
A market dozens of American cities will be watching. In New York, I'm Andrea Bernstein for Marketplace.
Speaking of those American cities, which one of them do you suppose is most cycle-friendly? And here's a hint, it's a city not mentioned in that story of Andrea's just now. The answer, though, is in our new online feature. It's called The Daily Nugget, and it's on our homepage, as is so much else. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
A final note this afternoon about money and politics in the Supreme Court's campaign finance ruling.
Till now, corporations influence politics with high-paid lobbyists and backroom deals. However, as much as corporate interests gave to politicians, we could never be absolutely sure they would do our bidding.
So it has come to this.
It's our democracy. We bought it, we paid for it, and we're going to keep it. That's why Murray Hill Incorporated is taking democracy's next step, running for Congress.
We called Murray Hill. It's a PR firm in Washington, D.C. They launched their campaign today on YouTube.
Vote Murray Hill Incorporated for Congress, for the best democracy money can buy.
I'm Eric Hensel, designated human for Murray Hill Incorporated. We approve this message.
I love that last bit, designated human. Anyway, that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 111 points, just over 1%, closed to 10,296. The NASDAQ up 18 points, not quite 1%, finished at 2190. The S&P 500 added on 14 points, 1.3%, wrapped up the day at 1103. Thanks to Jennifer Collins and Doug Krisner on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. That's where you can find all the latest business and economic news tomorrow on the Marketplace Morning Report. Coming up next time on this broadcast, the battle over bonuses.
Practically speaking, once you pay someone that money, typically they spend it.
Yeah. I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.